This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Some have finally come to realize that, like Gil Scott Heron and the Last Poets of the East Coast, the Watts Prophets were a major influence on the important culturally artistic movement called hip-hop. Unfortunately, many still aren't aware. With their raw, rhythmic, and brutally honest oration, the Watts Prophets set the tone for what their successors on the West Coast would know as rap. Golden era hip-hop pioneers like Ice-T, DJ Quick, Dr. Dre, and hosts of others would sample and draw from the sharp poetic works of three young men out of Watts named Otis O'Solomon, Richard Dido, and Omdi Hamilton. Their poetry weaved together the raw realities of life in South Los Angeles during the 1960s with conscious, thought-provoking messages that addressed institutional racism and integration, with reflective and critical perspectives on topics like political romanticism, class, and masculinity. Omdi Hamilton's piece, Pimpin', Leanin', and Fiendin', is one of those heavily honest and influential pieces that blend poetic rhythms with the very harsh realities of Watts' poor and tough community.
Pimpin', leanin', and fiendin'. Some say I'm dreamin', but I know I'm schemin'. Scufflin' and hustlin', slippin' and slidin'. Always hidin', heats around underground. Hangin' blacks in the courts, hustlers tryin' to stay off them white folks' jail reports. Pimpin', leanin', and fiendin'. White folks cold, black folks gettin' bold. Like let's blow up the world and send everybody to the moon in a blastin' way. In little bits and pieces like blood and guts, spread on a volcano, everybody smashed up. Pimping, leaning, and fiending. Shit, I ain't dreaming. Like I said before, I'm just scheming. Survival is my thing. Shooting dice for my life, trying always to win and always losing because of white folks choosing. Crackers constantly misusing blacks, abusing life, nature, babies, truth, the written word. The song of a bird, destroying air, hooking folks on horses, pimping, leaning, and fiending. Some think my thing is rest, dress, and requests. Sometimes I don't even have a permanent address. I'm a thinking man, forced to play a survival game, lame. I'm an educated man, with a doctor's degree, from SWU, Sidewalk University, pimping, leaning, and fiending. I ain't dreaming.
The Watts Prophets' explosive form of lyrics was being done way before the birth of rap and the unfortunate exploitation of today's rap industry. Back then, it was just an expression of ideas and feelings that hadn't yet been heard. Over the decades, these men struggled as artists and never really received the kind of notoriety or credit due as innovators of their craft. With exceptions of work like Jeff Chang's Can't Stop, Won't Stop, or Davey D's Hip Hop Journal, we might not know the contributions that were made by the Watts Prophets. On today's program, I have the privilege of speaking to Father Omdi Hamilton, the artist, priest, activist, and LA historian who was a big part of the Watts Prophets' voice. He begins our conversation with a reflection on an important artistic era of LA history that had a profound influence on his work.
When we moved out here from Houston, Texas, I was a little boy, and we moved right on Central Avenue, and this was in 1945. And I'm 46, I was 6 years old. So I got a chance to, as a little boy, live on Central Avenue and feel the excitement of a vibrating black lives, black community. And it was a fascinating place to be raised. That's where I left from there and went to Watts. And it was a fascinating community, a very lively, and, you know, people were coming there. It was during the time of the migration. People were really excited and working very hard to come up, to buy a home, to get a good job, to get in the union. All those things were very hard to do during that time. But it was just a lot easier. Watts was more of a community. We had, in fact, the Goodyear blimp parked right outside of Watts, right at Firestone and Central Avenue. We had Goodyear Tire Company there. We had Firestone Tire Company. We had General Motors. So it was a thriving and wonderful community, Los Angeles was. And it was always multicultural, but each community at that time was kind of segregated. The Hispanics lived in East L.A., the Caucasians lived in West Los Angeles, and the African-Americans lived up and down Central Avenue from 5th Street to about 120th. And on both sides of the streets were black businesses, clubs, all kinds of lodges. It was a wonderful, as I say, thriving black community. And a wonderful place to be raised. Watts in particular. We were kind of the bottom of the totem pole or the end of that. But you talk about what happened on Central Avenue. There were probably more jazz musicians on Central Avenue than there was in New York. But that story hasn't been told. People are beginning to tell it now. You know, Charlie Parker was here. He went to Camarillo from here. Billie Holiday. You can just go on. Because they were migrating from the South to get work in Hollywood. And when they didn't get that work, they would work up and down Central Avenue. So that's how you got to have so many and such a variety of great musicians who migrated just as they did to New York. They also migrated to Los Angeles. So that was a very... creative. It was just a wonderful and creative and lively community. You could hear music up and down the streets. Where I lived in Watts, you always heard drums. It was, you know, you'd hear cats like Mingus. I never saw Mingus, but he lived in the neighborhood. Eric Dolphy was always in the neighborhood. My crowd was more Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman, and those kind, Billy Higgins, they we were more close. They were a little older than I, but we were more close in age and went to the same parties and did the same dances and this and that. But Los Angeles was always a wonderful community, and particularly it had a wonderful African-American community.
I think it's important for people to understand what the history was like there in Los Angeles as far as the creative scene early on, because it's kind of gone through a number of different ebbs and flows as far as that goes. Later, during the 60s, after the Watts revolt, some people know it as the Watts riots. After that had happened, the Watts Writers Workshop had started up, and then a new creative movement had kicked on. I was wondering if you can kind of talk about that history now. You know, what happened with the Watts Revolt? You know, what sparked that, and then what came out of those ashes?
Well, many things. Lack of housing, lack of education, police brutality. That's what sparked the riots. But what caused there was already a black creative movement that was live and well when the Watts riots came along. You see, a little different than the South, we had our political movement in Los Angeles in the black community was in the church, but in Los Angeles it was also amongst the musicians. And it had started in the early 1940, I think, when Duke Ellington brought a play called Jump for Joy, I believe, to Los Angeles. And when he brought this play, it was kind of a militant kind of thing. And that's kind of where the civil rights movement became amongst the jazz musicians and all the musicians that were around in Los Angeles. That's how that movement began to grow. And so we already had a vibrant, this is the home of Charlie Mingus. This is the home of Don Cherry. This is the home of, you know, many, many great musicians. We didn't need anybody to bring us a new movement. We already had, amongst the musicians and artists, was always a civil rights movement and going along in Los Angeles amongst the artists, because we were fighting to get in Hollywood. We were fighting to get studio work. We were just as, you know, we were fighting a battle wherever we were, whether we were artists, politicians, priests, or prophet. So, African Americans were always battling, and we already had a musical kind. It was kind of amongst musicians, but the '60s brought us. Other people came to Watts, and they brought their ideas of art, and they said they brought us a new movement. So the movement changed from music to visual art. And African Americans don't visit museums. They go to concerts. And that was always our tradition. But though the art movement, if you identified in Los Angeles, the black art movement over the last 20 to 25 years, they kind of counted from the 1965 on. But we had a black vibrant movement already when 1965 came. Jane Cortez already had a workshop where she was teaching creative writing. You could go to the African American Union. We didn't need those type of workshops that came about in the 60s, because it was each one teach one. That was a tradition amongst us. You could go in the union and find Duke Ellington rehearsing and walk up to him and ask him to show you something, and he would. That's just the way it was in the African American community and up and down Central Avenue. I was a little boy, too young to really participate, but I always had wide eyes, and I was always looking and watching. And I would hear them talking when they would say, "Billie Holiday is down the street. Billie Holiday is down the street." My uncle and them would be going down there and this and that. So, but after the 60s, as I said, the integration was the disintegration of our artistic community in South Central Los Angeles, and something new came in. As I said, they replaced our already established black musical. It was more in the musical and genre. It then became a visual arts thing. And that movement kind of in South Central centered around the Watts Towers, the Mafundi Institute, the Watts Writers Workshop, et cetera. And what those things came about was a lack of area of expression. That's what the Watts Writers Workshop came about. That's how the Watts Prophets came about. We had no area of expression.
Well, and you were in the very beginning of that. You were part of that whole, I guess, movement, you know, taking place. What do you remember about kind of that being established, and you know, what was the atmosphere like at the time?
Atmosphere was up. You know, you had the Panthers, you had us, but most of all, you had the artists, which, you know, if you study now in the 1960s in Los Angeles, and you find about how they attacked the Panthers, and they attacked us, and they attacked the Muslims, but no one talks about the attack on the artist. The artist was the most dangerous thing to whoever didn't want things to change in Los Angeles, because we were singing it, dancing it, writing it, making plays about it, making movies about it. That's who had to really be dealt with, and they were quietly dealt with. Over the 60s, our careers were destroyed. Many, many things were done to artists who grew out of South Central Los Angeles.
What are some examples of how that was done? Or who was targeted in that, actually?
Well, the Watts Prophets were one of the groups that were targeted. We, you know, our careers were destroyed in so many, many different kind of ways. We weren't allowed over the years to make but two albums, although we made other albums ourselves, because we wanted to be independent anyway. But to really get into the commerciality, or to to make a living at what we were doing, and that's what we started out trying to do. We hoped that we could tell the truth and make a living doing it. You know how poets think grand thoughts. Well, we thought that people would actually buy the truth or listen to the truth on records and buy it as they were buying Marvin Gaye, etc. So that was our intentions, to open up an area of expression for those with no area of expression. And we got labeled militants, we got labeled racist, we got labeled all of these things, and we were really none of that. We were just people who wanted a better life in our communities. We wanted better jobs, we wanted better education, we wanted better housing, and we wanted to stop the overbearing and vicious police brutality that we were suffering in South Central Los Angeles. And finally, Rodney King was an example to show something that had been going on for a long, long time, way before Rodney King.
I remember you mentioning one time that Watts is a city that's kind of been, ever since the riots, has kind of been punished.
Yes.
It's like
like Haiti has been punished.
Yeah.
Yes, it's sort of like we have never been forgiven for that riot. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, as we kind of get into that, I think it's really important for people to know kind of what Watts is really about. I mean, we're talking about an area that's like 2 to 4 square miles, something like that, and a highly condensed population of people. Today, it's probably really known for a lot of the gang activity that's gone on there over the years. And you know, one of the stories that I covered was the Watts-Peace Treaty, which I thought was very pivotal and an important piece of history that's really overshadowed by the Watts riots, which is something that was really kind of, you know, exacerbated in the ways that the commercial media typically takes on stories like that. But, you know, I think it's important for people to know, you know, they're getting an understanding of what some of that history was back then, but there was a lot of tension during this time. You had talked about how there was some infiltration that was going on with, and this is a very real thing, you know, for those who aren't aware, there was the counterintelligence program that was put together by J. Edgar Hoover.
COINTELPRO was the name.
Yeah, COINTELPRO. It was basically a program designed to infiltrate groups that were part of the civil rights movements to break them up and to target leading figures of these organizations, and even to the point of assassination.
They burned the Watts Writers Workshop, which was started by Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg is the guy who did the film On the Waterfront. And the FBI burned our workshop to the ground.
That was the film On the Waterfront that he had done?
Yes, that was a very famous film. He won several Emmys for that. Bud Schulberg's a very famous writer and filmmaker and teacher, etc. He's the one who came down and started the Watts Writers Workshop shortly after the riot was simmering down. In fact, the fires weren't all out. And he came to Watts. He was a Los Angeles boy, and his people were rich. And he wanted to know what could he do. And he also was trying to revive his career at the same time. And so he came and he says, what can I do? And so he started a writer's class. And that's how the Watts Writers Workshop came about. And that workshop ended up, as I said, being burned down. The artists in that workshop, like the Watts Prophets, Ojinki, Kamau, and many of them, other writers, Yaphet Kotto came out of there. Their careers were, the majority of them, their careers were tampered with, and all this is a matter of record now. At that time, you know, we didn't know what was happening to us and to our careers. But now, as I said, as the research is being done and history is being revealed and the truth is coming out, our workshop was completely infiltrated by an African American who had infiltrated us, and his last act, as I said, was to burn it to the ground. That's what happened to our workshop.
Well, and my understanding is that the workshop was around, or the building was around, for some around 10 years before it was burned down.
Yes.
Give or take.
Oh, yes, right.
And
but, you know, what people don't understand, they always refer to the 60s as, you know, as they referring back. What they don't realize is the 60s was the planting of a seed. It's like the Watts Prophet's poetry that was wrote in the 60s is being listened to somewhere in the world right now. Marvin Gaye is being listened to somewhere in the world right now. Our work is not on our time limit. And we have planted seeds that will continue to bear fruit for years to come. We're seeing that. Some of us, like myself, who've had a chance to live and to be 70-some years old.
There's a couple things that I wanted to kind of mention as far as the Watts Prophets go. I mean, you guys were pure artists, but at the same time, very much involved in your community and very much spoke, I don't want to say on behalf of the community, but you helped to project that voice in a very good, in a very real way. And I think it still resonates today because a lot of the same struggles and a lot of the same issues that were facing the community back then are still facing the community today. But not only that, I mean, you can see the influence that exists with the hip hop culture today. Like I said, we, you know, a lot of the folks that are part of that hip hop culture today have gone through a lot of the same stuff that folks in the 60s were going through. And they're kind of just carrying on that tradition in a way. And I often hear the Watts Prophets compared to the likes of Gil Scott Heron and the Last Poets. But no one really knows who the Watts Prophets are. And to me, that's just an amazing thing because you guys, in my opinion, well, this isn't just my opinion. This is fact. You guys are pioneers.
Named the art form rap. There was no one that used the word ever on a rap that called a record rap or called it an art form as rap. There might have been people who talked on records and stuff like that before, but when the Watts Prophets came along, our first album in 1970 was called Rapping Black in a White World. We had been saying rapping, we'd been calling it an art form rap since we had started in 1967. Our first show opened with Rapping Blacks, Rapping Facts. Rapping Black, Rapping Facts. We knew we were poets, but we knew that we had something different going on the way we were doing call and response. And having to been around cats like Don Cherry, Billy Higgins, Horace Tapscott, some of the most creative men in the world, they saw that we had something different and encouraged us to develop this art form. But history has written us out of it. Not really, though, because the young people and cats like Jeff Chang, scholars are like that, and different scholars have went and researched it and saw there was the word rap means to talk, and it was a colloquial word used by African Americans, and particularly in the 50s and 60s. It meant, let me go rap to this sister. I'm going to rap to Carlos today. And so it was a common word for us. You know, it was an everyday word for us. And we added it to what we were doing. We knew we were poets, but we knew that we were rapping our poetry. Well, and we were trying to do it a little different.
And what would you say was that approach? You know, you talk about this being your, you know, what you did was a little bit different. I think you guys really stood out. You know, who was the Watts Prophets, and how did you guys formulate the productions that you guys would normally put together, or the pieces that you guys would put together?
We all were at the Watts Writers Workshop, and there were so many poets there that we started going out in groups. And me, Richard Dito, and Otis O'Solomon started to kind of being together all the time. So we started sitting down and coming up with concepts. If you did a poem about nature, I would try to do one about nature. If you done something negative, I would try to do something positive. and we'd begin to have a concept to our presentation. And that's sort of how, and it just sort of, it wasn't a big intellectual plan. It's sort of kind of like the music in the beginning, the Louis Armstrongs and the cats. It sort of just came out of us. It was just a part of us. It was like the last poets were doing the same thing that we were doing. They were all the way east, and we all were all the way west. We didn't know them, and they didn't know us. We began to know of each other as time went on. But they were doing their style. That's why you got a west, East Coast style, and we were doing our West Coast style. And but there were no one who called it rap. The music industry got the name rap from the Watts Prophet.
So you guys put it on the map?
Yes, we put it on the map. It wasn't our word. We didn't make the word, but it was a colloquial word.
Yeah. Well, that was the Watts Prophets, and you guys were very involved in your work during the 60s. And even then on, you guys have dealt with, you know, issues as serious as infiltration as far as breaking you guys down, but you guys continue. And you guys have persevered over the years. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on now and how can they help with the project that you're working on right now?
Well, I want to do maybe about a 6-song presentation, and it would be called Technical Difficulties. And having to be 72 years old and starting with the radio and watching the first TV come on the block and watching the radio's effects and then watching the TV's effects and then watching the computer effects and then watching cell phone effects and then watching all of this technology, I want to comment on it. And, you know, I have commented on it in the past in poems like, I hear people say, each and every day, that the internet will set modern man free like a dolphin in the sea. Why, this statement completely confused me. Since when, my friend, has a net set anything free? Now, my simpleness I regret, but where's the freedom in a net? Fishermen make nets, spiders weave webs, both the traps. The spider knows all in his web. He keeps it inside day or night, wrapped real tight with a click and a bite. Is it online or inline? Download, unload. Where's the freedom in a net? Stealth traps in your laps, net zero, hero, sky, tail, intel, DSL, email, tell. Processing your personal soul for info, no telling where it go. Only the net maker really knows. Now, you used to be able to shred it, but now that's jive. The hard drive is always alive. Wrap real, real tight with a click and a bite. Spider-Man can pull you up tonight. Why, free man freely entering a net will one day experience regret because there's no freedom in a net. Fishermen make nets. Spiders weave webs. Both are traps. The spider knows all in his web. He keeps it in sight day or night, wrapped real, real tight. Tell me, my friend, what spider has you in his website? Wrapped real, real tight with a click and a bite.
I want to thank you, Amdi, for your time today and enlightening us with some of the history of South Los Angeles and with some of your beautiful poetry. You know, I just want to wish you all the best in the future.
Well, I hope that some of the people will give me a hand in trying to do this project, and they can find my project on Kickstarter and review it if they'd like.
All right. Thanks a lot, Amdi.
Thank you.
Okay. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
That was Father Amdi Hamilton, one of the pioneers of the influential poetry group known as the Watts Prophets. To find out more about his work, or to help out with his latest project, check out the KBOO website at kboo.fm or at my blog at chucojournal.wordpress.com. That's C-H-U-C-O journal.wordpress.com. I've been your host, Carlos Chavez. Thanks for listening. Express yourself.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the KBOO News at Noon, followed by Moving On with Lori Sonnenfeld.
It's time for KBOO News at Noon. I'm Dan Johnson. When the vote was taken on New Year's Day to pass legislation that would avoid the so-called fiscal cliff, three congressmen from Oregon, all Democrats, voted no. Representatives Kurt Schrader, Peter DeFazio, and Earl Blumenauer opposed the bill, which was passed by the Senate. Many of the dissenters claimed the bill did not face the larger issue of reducing the deficit. If you've not heard, number 5 Oregon defeated number 7 Kansas State 35-17 in last night's Fiesta Bowl held in Glendale, Arizona. Go Ducks! The dream of retirement for Barney Frank may be postponed for a while if he is asked to fill the Senate seat held by John Kerry. Kerry has been nominated to fill the Secretary of State shoes worn by Hillary Clinton, who is retiring. Frank said that he would like to fill the seat on a temporary basis. By this time next week, gay marriage in Illinois may be legal. That is, if it can muster the votes needed for passage. A panel of legislators voted this past Thursday to send the bill legalizing gay marriage to the state Senate. A vote is expected sometime next week. You remember 15-year-old Malala, the Pakistani girl shot in the head by the Taliban because she advocated education for all girls. Well, Malala has progressed sufficiently enough to be released temporarily to spend time with her family. She will return to the